Edwina Farley with you on A Country Breakfast, where today we're meeting a man who doesn't mince his words.
Look, I'd like to see a cohesiveness. I'd like to see the collaboration of pastoral companies, farming companies, corporations, state governments, marketing Australia overseas as one. You know, the small mentality, ultra-competitiveness between companies and businesses or states on states, when you're overseas, just looks puerile.
We'll join Australia's well-known mining magnate, Andrew Forrest, on his Pilbara cattle station. Kath McAloon has a wrap of this week's rural news, and Kath, will it, what is going on with El Nino?
There's been a lot of speculation about the El Nino weather system when it was first forecast to arrive last year and it didn't show up, and now there's been talk that it will come this year, and there's even speculation that it could be one of the strongest El Ninos ever recorded. And of course, an El Nino is associated with hot and dry conditions in eastern Australia, so not good news for farmers who are already enduring drought conditions. And now this week, scientists have revealed that they expect that the forecast El Nino will be closely followed by the reverse weather system, which is the La Nina system, which brings wet weather. So for some areas of Australia, it could mean a swing from drought to flooding rains. CSIRO scientist Wenju Chai says he expects that the El Nino will be followed by a La Nina. He says it's happened before in Australia. In 1982 and 83, we had a really dry period, and then there were big floods in 1984, which came after the Ash Wednesday bushfire of 83. So it was a pretty bad situation. And also more recently, there were some really dry years leading up to 2011. And then you'll remember there were some big and pretty damaging
floods.
So the bad news, I guess, is that Dr. Chai says under global warming, strong El Ninos will happen more often. He's predicting they could happen once a decade, and he's saying there'll also be more instances where they're followed by La Ninas.
So under climate change, according to climate model, we are going to see this higher frequency of switching from El Nino to La Nina, one extreme to the opposite extreme from one year to the next.
Gee, we're just full of good news on the weather, aren't we? Some interesting developments this week with the fruit and veggies that we export to Papua New Guinea.
Well, the PNG government has actually put a ban on Australia sending vegetables to their country, and it means that Australia's offshore detention centres could run short of fresh produce. The local government in PNG says that it wants to develop the country's own vegetable industry, and it's blocked the import of Australian produce, which includes potatoes, onions and lettuces. And currently we send more than $3 million worth of fresh produce to Papua New Guinea every year. So it's likely to have a big impact on vegetable exporters in Australia. Joseph Sayina is from the Australian Horticultural Exporters Association, and he sees that it could lead to a shortage of fresh produce at some mining settlements and detention centres in PNG.
I don't know how they're going to feed those people, because these are what are staple lines: onions, potatoes, carrots, tomatoes. These are staple lines. These aren't luxury lines. And so that's going to be an interesting development over the next few days.
In better news for veggie growers, the falling dollar has been good news.
Yeah, so while PNG is a concern, vegetable exporters are actually having a pretty good time of it with a lower Australian dollar. It's helped to boost the nation's vegetable exports by $270 million last financial year. Our largest vegetable export market is Japan, but exports to Japan are falling. But while that's happening, there's been rising sales to the United Arab Emirates. They were up by 24%, and also to Singapore, where vegetable exports were up by 29%. Michael Coote is from Peak Industry Group AusVeg, and he says demand for carrots, broccoli and potatoes in the Middle East will continue to increase.
Obviously, being a desert climate, they don't produce a significant amount of their own fresh produce. So the Australian produce that makes it over there is seen as very very high quality and safe, and is fairly well desired in this market.
We often talk about productivity gains when it comes to being, you know, competitive in farming and being a more successful farmer. some interesting news this week on the countries that are actually achieving that.
Yeah, some new research has found that Australian farmers are finding it harder to compete with their farmer counterparts in New Zealand, Brazil and South Africa. So the Australian Farm Institute has been doing a 10-year study and it's looking at those three countries and found that they're experiencing strong productivity growth, while the Australian farm sector, which is often hailed as being sort of one of the better, you know, farm sectors in the world and very productive, very efficient, but the Australian Farm Institute Head Mick Keogh says that there are concerns about Australia, including the exchange rate, the availability of land for farming in Australia, and particularly about research and development and adopting some of that technology on farm. And he says that's possibly plateauing in Australia.
Unfortunately, we've moved to a model here, particularly in our major universities, where they've become an education business that's focused on overseas students because they generate more revenue. And I think we've lost the connection between the researchers and the industry.
It's interesting that Mick Keogh mentions research because that's been echoed in another fairly significant report looking at agriculture.
Yeah, it's a concern that's backed up by the author of a report that's looked at specifically at the trends that are likely to impact Australian agriculture into the future, into the next 20 years. And one of the authors of that report is also worried that research in Australia into agriculture isn't keeping pace with other countries. So this report from the CSIRO and the Rural Industries Research and Development Corporation found that the key sort of issues that were going to have an impact on farmers, on what they grew and how they sold what they grew, would be climate change, population growth, a growing global middle class, choosier shoppers that had sort of higher expectations about what the products they buy, but also new technology. And researcher Stefan Hajkiewicz says there's been big gains in the past in Australia in grain and beef production because of research and development, but he worries that that's now starting to slow.
That's been associated with big jumps in the amount of wheat we can produce per hectare, for example. But we are slackening off. We are not continuing the same rates of productivity growth and improvement that we used to have. And I think that's the risk, is that other countries may not be taking their foot off the accelerator.
The Michael Clarke of the cricket world may not have been able to stage a huge turnaround in the Ashes, but his wine namesake has.
Well, one of Australia's largest wine groups, the Treasury Wine Estates, has reported a massive turnaround. When you think about it, Treasury this week posted a net profit of more than $77 million, and that comes after the previous year of losing more than $100 million. And you'd remember that it was just sort of 18 months ago that we were hearing about Treasury, particularly their wineries in the US, where they were tipping billions and billions of litres of wine.
Amazing pictures, weren't there?
Yeah, they were just tipping it down the drain because they were so oversupplied and the prices just weren't there for it. So, they were really in the dog Doldrums there for a while, but after that they brought in a new chief executive and they sort of described last year as a bit of a reset year where they cut costs and they sold off a US winery. Now Treasury owns some of the big name brands in Australian wines like Penfolds, Lindeman's, Wolf Blass, Rosemount, some of the ones that you'd be familiar with, and they're now reporting that they're back in the black, I guess, back making a profit. And part of that, according to the new chief executive Michael Clarke, is because there's been increasing wine sales in Asia.
We are continuing to invest in both our brands and our capability, and our outlook for the region remains very positive. We have only just unlocked the opportunities of the Chinese market, and investors can expect Japan and Korea to follow as we reshape and enhance our route to market in these regions.
Australian Agricultural Company is one of those really well-known northern pastoral companies, and it's taken a big punt on setting up an abattoir outside Darwin. How is it going with that?
When the Australian Agricultural Company set up that abattoir, they sort of thought that they'd be, processing their own animals for a start, and they've been doing that. But now they're sort of sending out the call more widely for other people to offer animals to be killed at the Darwin Meatworks. But they're having a bit of trouble. Livestock agent Paul McCormack says the hunt is now on for heavy cattle, but there's also a lot of competition for those type of cattle.
We're seeing a lot of pressure come from southern and eastern meatworks, and on top of that, there's live export pressure still. You know, the jury's still out what's going to happen with the latest movements on Indonesian slaughter permits. So if we add those to the mix, I really see a lot of pressure coming towards this cow job in the next 2 to 3 months.
And if they're that valuable, then it possibly leads to other factors as well.
Perhaps no surprise then that police in Queensland say that reports of stock thefts in their state are rising as cattle become more valuable. And police have appealed for public help over the theft of more than 400 cattle from a North Queensland property. It sounds crazy that someone could just, you know, sort of drive up and load 400 head of cattle onto a truck and drive away. But Detective Senior Sergeant Jim Lacey says because of the high cattle prices and cattle really being in demand, and also because of the drought, graziers are becoming a bit more concerned about where their cattle are.
Yeah, cockies are missing every beast. Difficult to get your 100% musters. So when prices are low, if they're missing 20 head, they may not think anything more of it and think they'll turn up next time. At the moment, prices are good, times are hard. So 20 head means a lot to them.
I do like this next story. Someone's been having a good lend of tourists out in the outback.
Yeah, a fast food restaurant sign that was found in the middle of the Simpson Desert has become a bit of an unlikely outback tourist attraction. So the sign that has the McDonald's golden arches that people would be familiar with, and it says, "Macca's coming soon," was placed by some artists. It's believed it was put out there by artists out in the middle of the desert. And it was found by local park rangers. The sign has since fallen into the possession of Phil Gregurk at the Mungarani Hotel, which is about halfway up the Birdsville track in northeast South Australia, and he's put it up near his pub, sort of in the middle of nowhere, I guess. But he says tourists are loving stopping off and taking photos of the sort of incongruous fast food restaurant sign in the middle of the desert.
Oh, it's a full-blown McDonald's opening here soon sign. And it was actually lit by two solar lights. I always thought the bar at the pub was the most photographed item that we had here. But no, everybody wants to take this, to take a picture of me bus stop with a Macca sign next to it.
Oh, I love it. Social media no doubt loved it too.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Thank you, Kath.
Thanks, Edwina.
If you want to check out the sign, hop onto the ABC Rural Facebook page. And of course, if you want to keep in touch with all of these rural news stories, you can subscribe to our daily newsletter, abc.net.au/rural.
Here's a story that should be in every school textbook. How Australia tested Einstein in 1922. International science at its best, and perhaps the most important physics discovery ever made in Australia.
Did you know that? The first run of light bending recorded in 1919 was dodgy, so our guys had to step in. Now in the centenary year of relativity, the Science Show puts history straight. The Science Show today at noon on RN.
Edwina Farley with you for A Country Breakfast. Let's join our rural reporters. This week, tiny sugar gliders find a nice new warm home in the Bega Valley. We follow the fortunes of Aboriginal stockman Wyatt Nipper as he prepares for his very first bull ride. And check out what's on the menu at the Clifton Street Primary School in Victoria's Gippsland. How many kids do you know who'd happily tuck into pickled kimchi and Jerusalem artichokes?
You'd be surprised how they warm up to it. And I've had kids queuing up, even the stuff that kids are meant to hate, like broccoli. I've had kids fighting each other for the last bit of broccoli frittata. You know, once they come to the idea that it's not going to kill them, they'll have a go. I've been really quite surprised sometimes.
Some exciting things on the menu there at Clifton Street Primary, but would they and you consider eating alpaca? Yes, alpaca meat. A group of producers in Western Australia wants people to give it a go.
It's actually very tasty. It's delicious. The texture and quality, the meat is it's actually very mild. A lot of the impressions were it would be quite gamey, but it's not. It's a very mild meat, and it takes on flavours that you cook with very well.
Where are you, little Eve?
Come on.
There are some pretty exotic dishes appearing on restaurant menus these days. But just how would you feel about eating alpaca? Yes, you heard correctly, alpaca. These cute native South American animals are perhaps better known for their luxurious fleece than their meat. But a group of farmers in Western Australia wants that to change and have alpaca available in butcher shops and high-end restaurants. Hello, I'm Olivia Garnett. Marlon Hotker has around 260 alpacas on his property on the outskirts of Albany in the southwest of Western Australia. As we hand-feed a group of his finest girls, he's quick to distinguish between his stud animals and those destined for the abattoir.
These all have names because these are all not meat ones. Meat ones don't get names.
The animals we use for meat, once they're weaned, they get put off into a paddock to grow out, fatten up. They don't get the amount of attention and handling that the stud animals get.
They don't get a name or a cuddle like you're giving this one here.
No, that's right. They just get a number. Like any other livestock, they just end up with a number. We started down this road about 18 months ago, and I would say the response then was probably 50-50, for and against. But now we find it's only the odd person that says, oh, how could you eat them? Because the reality is that they're no cuter than a baby goat or a baby lamb anyway.
Marlon Hotker is a member of the National Alpaca Association. The group's actively recruiting alpaca growers to join the meat supply chain and find a use for their excess stock.
As with any industry, we needed an outlet to cull, because otherwise you fill up your property with animals and you can't progress. So having a meat industry allows us to cull the animals. We're getting really good product out of it, and we can keep breeding and improving the quality of the herd.
So essentially you're turning a fleece animal into a multi-purpose animal with the hide, the fleece and the meat.
That's right, yes. It's every aspect of the alpaca is really good. Beautiful fleece. The meat from the animals is exceptionally good, very healthy, and the hides are beautiful.
A few alpaca breeders have told me that meat is exceptionally healthy. How does it differ to other meats?
Alpaca meat is very low in fat. It's possibly the lowest in fat of any grazing animal, and also the highest in iron. So it is very good for you.
Is there a concern in the industry that if you start going down the meat for consumption road, that you'll run out of animals because their supply is certainly an issue?
Supply is an issue, and we don't want to create a market we can't supply. It's being well received, and we're just treading slowly, very slowly, increasing our customer base so we can be quite sure we can maintain supply, because it would be very easy to oversell and run out of product.
So is alpaca meat proving popular with diners? Those who've tried it say it's got a buttery texture, similar in flavour to milk-fed veal. Damien Whiteley runs a restaurant in Albany that's been experimenting with alpaca rack on the menu.
It's very easy to use. It often needs to be quick cooked on a higher heat to bring out the best. I'd compare it closely to veal, but with a little bit more texture. People order it, and I think they expect a more powerful flavour from it, something like camel. And when it comes out, it's quite subtle. It's got quite a warm reception from the few people that have tried it.
And what does it look like? Is it quite a light coloured meat? How would you describe what it looks like on the plate once it's cooked?
It's a very white meat. It's a little bit like pork in colour. It's not really prominent in any way from any other meat. And especially the fact that it's a light flavour, I think it would be really popular in the mainstream market.
So your feedback has been largely positive from the people who have been game enough to try the alpaca on your menu. But is alpaca in your restaurant, is it more of a blackboard special, or can you see it down the track being part of a permanent part of the menu?
We have had it on the menu permanently several times, but it hasn't really moved. It hasn't caught on as much as what we would have hoped and thought. So in the future, unless it does catch on a bit more, which we hope so, it probably will be moved to more of a blackboard special.
While Marlon Hotke might see an exciting future in breeding alpacas for their meat, the same can't be said for fellow Western Australian farmer Peter Eads. He says he'd never consider it for his herd.
Is that a typical alpaca sow?
No, it's not typical. It's a serene special.
So she's just very... Oh, hello. She's very excited about eating out of your hand this morning. Hello, girls.
Full stop.
So, Peter, you've got them all named?
Oh, they're all very much named, yes.
Yeah?
Yes, they're all very much named and very much part of the family.
So who do we have here?
Well, this is Jamila, and Jamila won't eat now because that one just spat. And this is my little Peruvian one here, and her name's Nigella. You don't have any two that are the same. Trying to chop them up for mincemeat or neck chops, it's a bit hard for me. Other people look at them different because they treat them as farm animals, but I don't. No.
So there is a network of alpaca growers who are pushing to make an industry out of alpaca meat.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I can understand that if they've got excessive animals, then obviously they're going to have to do something with them. I never pushed the sale of them, but I don't think the sale of them is very good, and consequently they're going to have to do something with them if they keep breeding. I stopped breeding about probably 3 or 4 years ago now.
So what would go through your mind if you sat down at a restaurant in Albany and saw alpaca served up on the front page?
I'd probably order some shrimp or fish or something else. I wouldn't order alpaca, no, because I'd be thinking of what I had. I mean, it'd be like eating your own kids here. They're not really animals. Well, I mean, they are, but, you know, they're very affectionate, very friendly animals, and very inquisitive animals, I might add, too.
They're no cuter, some would argue, than a baby lamb or a goat.
Not, no, but the thing about it is that they are very affectionate, and as I say, they're all part of the family. Now, look at this one here. Pepper. But, I mean, it's up to them what they want to do. Yeah, so there you go. My pet girl.
Yeah, so I'm Ali Rodway, and I'm the coordinator of the Far South Coast Conservation Management Network. So what we're doing is visiting one of the landholders in this area who's called Doug Somerville, and he's put up a lot of nest boxes across his property, 50 nest boxes, for sugar gliders. And so he's doing his 6-monthly survey, and we're just coming along for the ride and checking out what's in the boxes.
And to get to the nesting boxes perched high up in the tree branches, you need to bring along a ladder. Hello, I'm Josh Becker. Sugar gliders would have to be the cutest little marsupials you can find. They look like a tiny little possum, weighing in at just 160 grams, and spend their nights gliding between the trees in search of food. As their name suggests, they love their nectar, but they're partial to insects too. Sugar gliders usually live in old tree hollows, but if those aren't available, then a purpose-built nesting box is the next best thing. Doug Somerville's property lies in the Bega Valley on the far south coast of New South Wales.
There's 50 boxes around the property, and I've only found one with a family in it, and 9 out of those 10 bud are active, so they've got remnants of some activity, usually leaf matter, so a whole bunch of eucalypt leaves sort of all balled up and taking up half the box. You just see a bunch of sort of ears and heads and tails and things, so I don't like getting in there and disturbing them. So you just make out that there's more than one, and so there's going to be a mum and dad and a few offspring probably from the previous litter still in the family group, which is pretty normal. I have come across big single sugar gliders on their own, which I would assume would be sort of males being kicked out, sort of freelancing around the place.
Why are you up checking them today?
I want to see the rate of occupation over time. They'll start sort of doing things next month, if you like, nesting and raising another batch of young. So I'm just, every 6 months, I want to go in and just check to see how many are occupied and over what time. I'm sort of curious, given all these trees throughout wherever the nest box has been put are less than 25 years old. So it's just interesting to see how fast these little fellas sort of move through the tree lines and into the tree lots, given there's no natural hollows through this whole system network.
With the natural hollows, why is that important for sugar gliders?
Well, we've got a whole bunch of native birds and marsupials, little anaconas, native mice, bats, and a lot, most of our marsupials require hollows to live in. If they don't have hollows, then they'll struggle to find somewhere safe to reproduce. So by putting the nest boxes up, sort of encouraging the sugar gliders into this particular area. I sort of not just like the idea of the sugar gliders, you know, little cute things, but they're reputed to eat a hell of a lot of Christmas beetles. And earlier, when we had younger trees, for a couple of years, we would get decimated by the Christmas beetles. So I figure putting up the sugar glider nest boxes, if I can attract them into these plantings, it should take care of some of those Christmas beetles. And so far it has, but it's, you know, we haven't had any significant damage at all from Christmas beetles, so that's encouraging. But when they do, they can certainly make a mess of a whole bunch of trees. And so having a whole bunch of things that like eating them is a good idea, as far as I'm concerned.
So exciting! Oh my god, it's a nest! Like, you put your hand in and it's a lovely sort of... I shouldn't disturb it. Wow! Yeah, no, and they're quite green, those leaves.
Yeah, that's right. When you open the lid, you can see them all curl up in a big cluster. In the wintertime, they're buried underneath all the leaf matter and you can't see them. So you sort of weave your hand down very tentatively, just feeling for a bit of fur. And you feel the fur and right, that's it. Because so far they haven't nipped any fingers. But
yeah, I think it's really important because the animals that could occupy those sites would be beneficial to farmers, you know, just in terms of natural pest control and also, you know, just the joy of having them moving across the landscape again and being...
Yeah, they're pretty cute looking animals. I mean, they'd be hard, you'd hard be pressed not to want them on your farm, wouldn't you?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty, people get a lot of joy from bringing animals back to places that they haven't been for a while.
Ali Rodway from the Conservation Management Network, checking out those cute little sugar gliders that now call Doug Somerville's property home. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, some students forage for their food in Victoria's Gippsland, and it's rodeo time in the Kimberley.
I just want to join in with the boys, see my mates riding it, and he said it's all right, like it's fun, and I said I want to have a crack, we want to challenge ourselves.
Are you worried about the danger?
No, I'm all right.
Warm your rope up and down a couple of times.
Wyatt Nipper just wants to be one of the boys, and if that involves climbing onto the back of a bucking bull and trying to hang on for an 8-second adrenaline-pumping ride, then so be it. G'day, I'm Tom Edwards. At the Kununurra Rodeo in the far north of Western Australia. Wyatt's an experienced horseman, but this is his first bull ride. To prepare himself, he's been to rodeo school for the past couple of days, learning some of the basics, how to position himself on the bull and grip his hand on the rope. But he's about to have a go at the real thing. That bull there, Wyatt, looks pretty angry to me. Aren't you concerned about getting on a beast like that?
No.
What makes you so confident, though?
I might be a little bit nervous when I get there.
How do you think you'll do?
Might do all right. Well, first time.
You think you're going to fall off?
I reckon I might, might hang on for a long time.
It's pretty intense. What's going through your mind?
I don't know, man. Rush. Pumped up.
Are you nervous?
Yeah, very nervous.
What do you think about the atmosphere here?
Dusty. It's a bit dusty, yeah.
We can see some bulls just near where we're standing right now. What do you think about the look of them?
They look pretty big.
You're still going to go ahead?
Yep, see how it goes.
Hold on.
Retired.
I'll leave you to it. Good luck. While Wyatt heads off to the chutes and his moment of destiny, I've managed to find another couple of would-be rodeo champions in the crowd. James and Embelio aren't tackling the bucking bulls. These youngsters are lining up for the poddy calf ride.
Yeah, I've done it a few times.
Are you nervous?
Oh, a little bit.
How long do you reckon you're going to last?
Oh, I don't know, just yet.
How many times have you done it?
Like two or three times. No, yeah, two.
How's it gone in the past?
Yeah, all right.
Why do you want to do this?
Oh, I don't know, just for a fun sport.
What do you like about it?
Just hanging under a calf, really, and getting bucked.
There's a lot of people watching here.
Yeah, I know.
Does that make you more nervous?
A little bit, yeah.
Are you looking forward to it?
Yeah.
Good luck.
Bye-bye. It's like a good sports and stuff like that. Like you win money and buckles and ribbons and stuff.
And what are you expecting tonight here in Kununurra?
To win it.
You're pretty confident.
Yeah, because I've been rowing before.
How many years have you been doing that?
When I was 6 years of age, so, 4 years ago.
So already quite a few years of experience behind you.
Yeah.
So back to the main arena and the novice bull ride where Wyatt Nipper's name has been called. Wyatt's just climbing up now. The kicker's in place. He's looking pretty nervous. They're just taping a glove onto his right hand. He's now sat on the bullock. He's got his helmet on, just moments away from his first ever bull ride. They're about to open the gate. And then they've opened the gate. Right, he's off. And the animal's booking quite up. He's still on. He's gone into the middle of the arena. He's still on. He's on. Oh, no, he's gone down. And a very, very respectable effort there. All of that preparation just for a few seconds on the animal. Quite incredible. How was it?
It's all right. Too quick.
How many seconds did you last?
I don't know, man.
Was it better than you imagined?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah. It was fun.
What was the most difficult part?
Coming out of the chute. Yeah.
What was it about coming out of the chute that was such a challenge?
I had to sit up forward, yeah. Sit on him. Wait for him to come out.
You're his friends. How do you think he did?
Yeah, he done good for a first rider. Tried to hang in there. Yes, was off balance at the first jump, I guess.
How did you fall off?
On my back.
Did that hurt at all?
A little bit.
Would you do it again?
Yeah, I'll try it again whenever the next rodeo is.
Well, congratulations on your first bull ride.
Yeah, thanks for that. Looking forward to the next one.
Hi, I'm Hayley and I'm from Clifton Creek.
And Hayley, what are you doing at the moment?
We are going to build some scarecrows for our garden.
Why do you need a scarecrow?
Because the birds keep trying to peck our food and we would like it to stop, so we need some scarecrows.
What's on the menu at your school? I bet it doesn't feature stinging nettle pizza, Warrigal greens pesto or fat hen curry. Hello, I'm Laura Poole at the Clifton Creek Primary School in Victoria's East Gippsland. This small country school may only boast a couple of classes, but it's taken its kitchen garden program to a whole new level. They're not just cooking with veggies and herbs growing in these garden beds. These enterprising youngsters go foraging for their food as well.
Filled up three wheelbarrows nice and full. Reverse fever on. We'll be ready.
So my name's Jill Hermans and I'm working here at Clifton Creek Primary School as the kitchen garden specialist, or the garden specialist.
And what's happening in the garden today?
So this morning we've harvested lots of vegetables to go into the kitchen. We've picked some nice big fat leeks and some Jerusalem artichokes for roasting.
So Jerusalem artichoke, it's perhaps not something everyone's been exposed to. How do the kids react to some of these newer vegetables?
They react really well. For the philosophy is that everyone tries a little bit of everything. And yeah, we've had lots of different vegetables this year that kids have all tried and absolutely loved. Kohlrabi was another new one that we grew this year and had a really good crop of. And they made cauliflower and kohlrabi gratin. And it was absolutely loved.
You've also worked with ingredients not just from the garden but also what you found out and about.
Yeah, so we did a bit of foraging in February, which was great fun. So the kids learnt about the weeds that we have growing around and how they might not necessarily, you know, even though they're weeds, they're actually quite edible and delicious and useful or medicinal.
And we can hear some hammering in the background. It looks like the garden's constantly evolving and expanding.
It is, yeah, it is. It's getting bigger and bigger, which is a wonderful thing because you can never have too many garden beds.
Hi, I'm April. I'm a parent and I come up to Clifton Creek to help out with the kitchen garden program.
And what does your son get out of the program?
It's been great for him to be out actually in the garden learning about all the different plants, and he really enjoys getting in the garden and helping there. My son was at one of the largest schools in Bairnsdale. He's on the autism spectrum, so he was finding it really difficult with the masses of people at some of the schools. So we brought him up to Clifton Creek. It's fantastic. He's in a small classroom. He gets the attention that he needs. His education's been really individualised to suit him.
You better start working hard, Michael, because that dirt's about to come.
I'm David. I'm a teacher from Clifton Creek Primary School.
How does this fit into the school curriculum?
So it's pretty good. So with the garden aspect of it, we generally do some literacy cookbooks and we write our own magazine. And in the kitchen, we actually do a little bit of maths and conversion with units and stuff like that, so it's pretty good.
Do you enjoy being out here?
Oh, definitely, especially the Thursday lunchtime when we put on a bit of a smorgasbord banquet, so can't complain, don't have to bring lunch out.
What we're going to need is a big stainless steel bowl.
John Ireland, I'm the kitchen specialist at Clifton Creek in the Stephanie Alexander Kitchen Garden Program.
And what's on the menu today?
We're doing a soup out of whatever veggies we've got in the garden, celery, turnips, leeks, those sort of things. We're making some kimchi out of cabbage that we can use next week. It takes a week to ferment.
How do the kids react to foods that they might not have come across before, like the kimchi and the artichokes that aren't quite so common?
they have their moments, is the best thing I could say there. But look, you'd be surprised how they warm up to it. And I've had kids queuing up, even the stuff that kids are meant to hate, like broccoli. I've had kids fighting each other for the last bit of broccoli frittata. You know, once they come to the idea that it's not going to kill them, they'll have a go. I've been really quite surprised sometimes.
It's got a strange flavour, so we'll taste a little bit.
They've got no pips, so they can't be tomatoes.
No, they're not tomatoes. Just taste that.
Yep.
And you're working with what's coming out of the garden, but you've also had a foraging element to the program as well. Can you talk about what that involved?
Well, we're interested in cooking all sorts of unusual things when we can get them. So we cook funny little things like yakons, which are under-the-ground things. And we also, earlier in the year, ventured into what you can find virtually on the roadside. So stinging nettles, warrigal greens that grow all around the beaches on the Gippsland Lakes. Fat hen, which is a weed that people often have in their garden. That makes really, really nice curry. The warrigal greens, we ended up making a pesto out of them. And we made stinging nettle pizzas. And the kids got into them. They loved it.
Very unusual.
It's unusual, isn't it?
John Ireland rustling up some interesting food there in the kitchen at the Clifton Street Primary School in eastern Victoria, and fighting over the broccoli frittata. I'm not sure about that, but it certainly beats the pies and toasted sandwiches on offer back in my day. It's a name most of you know well, but it's usually associated with Australia's resources and mining industries. Andrew Forrest, or Twiggy as he's colloquially known, has captured the attention of a nation that likes to glory in the self-made man. But he's not all about mining. 4 years ago, Andrew Forrest and his wife Nicola bought back the Pilbara cattle station where he grew up. Mindaroo, as it's known, covers 1.8 million acres near the town of Onslow in WA, and it runs a composite herd, or a mixed herd if you like, that's being bred specifically for Australia's fine dining market. Earlier this year, the couple revealed their plans to pursue organic certification at the station within the next couple of years. Our reporter Lucy Bell took a tour of Mindaroo, where drought-proofing has been a major focus for the Forrests.
Well, the river's the lifeblood of Mindaroo Station, and, you know, we have a painting hanging in the homestead which has got the Ashburton depicted as a river of gold, and that's how we see water. And you look at this soil and you add water and you can grow anything. Oh, Lucy, good morning. It's Nicola Forrest and I'm here at Mindaroo Station. What you're seeing here is one of our ultra black weaners, and it's a beautiful little heifer, and she's standing with another different kind of cross red heifer that we actually brought in last year. What we're breeding here is a composite, and what you can see here in the yards is that in the working. So we pretty much had a centre pole herd when we bought the station back, and we've brought in different bulls and covered Droughtmaster, we've brought in Red Angus and the Ultra Blacks. We like the Angus line because we like the thick carcass and body that it puts on the leg that we've got here.
A lot of the time, a lot of our southern stations run Angus. Have you had any sort of challenges being up here in the Pilbara with a different kind of climate?
Well, I guess that's where the
the breeding and the drafting is so important because, you know, once we get a little bit too much hair, they're beautiful cattle, but we can't keep them here for the long term. So they're great for us as trading cattle. So we're going for the finer coat, which is where the ultra black is giving us that black without the heavy coat.
Have you got a timeline for breeding up the ideal herd?
I think that, you know, we're looking at a 5-year time plan here of being able to consistently send off to market every fortnight.
A lot of stations around you guys here in the Pilbara, they're also facing similar challenges. I wondered if you thought there was anything particularly that you were doing at Mindaroo which was a bit cutting edge that people could maybe learn a lesson from.
I think what we're doing over at South Mindaroo, which is on Uraru Station, we've just built a set of cattle yards. And what we're going to provide there for local producers is that we're actually putting a weighbridge in, and it's going to give them a chance to sell their cattle pretty much straight from the station, which I think is cutting edge. They can have their cattle stockpiled there at Uraru and then taken down south. There's a huge demand for cattle at the moment everywhere, and we want to obviously first of all look after our domestic market.
And just personally, Nicola, it's something that has been a particular challenge or a particular reward for you since coming to Mindaroo?
I think finding the right team to run a place like this is a huge challenge, and that has been really satisfying that we have got a great team here.
Mindaroo Station might be remote, but its owner is never far from the headlines. Since I visited Mindaroo, there have been several reports of Andrew Forrest's efforts to allegedly block mining exploration on his station by rival companies. Some business commentators have made the point that that's quite an ironic move, given that Mr. Forrest's own first iron ore mine, Cloudbreak, is situated on Mulga Downs Station, which is owned by his rival Gina Reinhardt. Andrew Forrest has also recently made moves to purchase 2 more pastoral stations in the neighbouring Gascoyne region, which will take his pastoral land holdings in Western Australia to more than 1 million hectares. And that's in addition to owning Harvey Beef, a processor in the state's south. While expansion is obviously on the cards, at Mindaroo, station manager Ben Ratton is simply focused on what's in front of him, and that's achieving organic certification.
There's been a lot of development in the last 18 months with the herd. Infrastructure, we've set a lot of goals where we want to be. We're using genetics and the natural state of the land to drive production.
Can I get you to elaborate on that a little more? Ben, what do you mean when you said genetics? What are you breeding for?
We aim to breed an animal that thrives in our environment where we are here in the Pilbara. And when I say thrive, I mean, you know, holds its condition very well, produces weaners hopefully every year, and also at the end of the day is exactly what a customer wants to eat if they are in a fine dining restaurant. So we need to tick all those boxes, and because we will be all organic, obviously we don't want to lose production. So instead of using growth promotants and a lot of the products that are available today, we want to stay organic, and we're using selection of genetics that suit our country and what the customer wants to eat at the end of the day. We're using that to drive productivity.
When it comes to making sure that you comply with all of those organic certification needs, is it tricky in terms of, say, land care, for example, weeds management?
It is, with as far as woody weeds go, where the most effective treatment is chemicals. But, you change your management program to work around those hurdles, so maybe a quarantine of a paddock just to show and ensure that animals are exposed to those areas, don't become part of the organic herd. But, the treatment of woody weeds is also essential as part of our land management, so that's not something that we're going to stop doing. We need to be able to manage both.
We've been very lucky in the Pilbara. We've had a lot of rain of late. Your paddocks are looking luscious and green, but we do know that we have failed wet seasons. What happens then with organic certification and making sure that you can keep feed up to the cattle?
Well, I think that is the hurdle for most producers in the Pilbara. It is historically can be very dry and for consecutive years. So a part of a strategy that we're starting to implement now is develop some farming where we grow organic fodder. So it's drought-proofing Mindaroo, where we don't have to sell down our stock, where we do get a consistent flow of finished cattle, but they're still eating an organic product grown on site.
And how many pivots have you got to grow that fodder?
We have 1 operational, we have 2 going in as we speak. We're going to obviously learn from those 3 pivots how we can do it more effectively going forward. And so long as it's sustainable what we're doing and we have enough water, who knows where we'll end up.
Access to consistent, plentiful water supplies is what this plan really relies on. And if you've ever seen photos of that rich red Pilbara dirt which stretches right across the region, you might wonder to yourself, well, where is it? Where is the water here? The answer is largely underground, in aquifers. And Andrew Forrest says tapping into those aquifers is the way forward for industry. He's teaming together with 30 universities from around the country to explore the possibilities for tapping groundwater. And he says an upside-down weir, which he has built here at Mindaroo, at a cost of more than $1 million, proves his theory can work.
When the season's great, that's when you work the hardest on drought-proofing, because you know the seasons are going to turn. The trouble in paradise in Australian agriculture, and particularly here in the Pilbara, is drought. And so we've developed a system which we're in the early stages of rolling out here. We've proved that it works, and that's to put in weirs which are basically upside down. Instead of trying to trap the surface water, we're out to trap the groundwater, to slow the groundwater drainage out to the ocean where it wastes, and to utilise it here on the land. And that's had a really quite a dramatic impact. It's lifted the water table by several metres. It's sweetened the water considerably. And you can see in the lushness of the vegetation around here, it's made a striking difference. So we attach a centre pivot or two or three to that massively increased groundwater storage, and then repeat that process upriver several times, so that when drought hits, which is inevitable here in Australia, when drought hits, we might have to bring the numbers back down again, say from 22,000 to 12,000, but maintain that beautiful bloodline which we've bred up for this kind of country and for the fine dining restaurants.
In terms of creating a whole bunch of upside down weirs in a riverbed, I imagine that would have been a fairly costly and timely exercise. I'm wondering how applicable that would be for other stations.
I think if you've got creeks or rivers or anywhere, and if you've got farming country, you're definitely going to have those. Even in outback stations, you'll always have drainage. It might not be river frontage, it'll be creek frontage and the like, and wherever you have that, I'm hoping that the Waters and Rivers Commissions, the large bureaucratic departments which operate in all governments in Australia, can see what's happened here and see that it's really worked. People don't have to go and blaze the same trail, which is costly and time-consuming, that we have at Mindaroo, because we've proven absolutely that slowing up the groundwater discharge to the ocean is a spectacular way of improving the land. And environmentally, you just can't argue against it, because the results are all around you.
When you say results, what do you mean?
Well, by the richness of the flora, the fauna, and particularly even aquaculture in the river. You know, Mother Nature delivered here in the Ashburton a monoculture of catfish. Now, since we put that weir in, and you've got much more permanent, sustainable, large river pool systems which stretch all the way out to the oceans most times, the aquaculture variety has dramatically increased. You get barramundi, leather jacket, catfish, eel, all fantastic, you know, dining fish. And only a few years ago, before that weir went in, none of that existed. And it's actually the change in richness and diversity of the aquaculture which was the most obvious difference of that upside-down weir.
Obviously, in places like Queensland, though, there are some competing interests around some of those big water basins, particularly mining. I mean, how do you, I suppose, push agriculture's need for those water basins higher than mining's needs for those water basins at a federal and state level?
Look, I don't think they need to compete at all. If one industry is not sustainable on a permanent basis, it shouldn't exist. Mining, for instance, must be sustainable, and it must work with the agricultural industries and the communities in which it resides. And agriculture, exactly the same. Agriculture must have the same sustainability, and if you can do that, then you have a completely sustainable industry.
You have got a real focus particularly on the Kimberley and the Pilbara, obviously with a lot of your operations here, but have been a spokesperson for industry across the north in general. I wonder what you would like to see in the coming year for the industry, and particularly for the Kimberley and the Pilbara and our pastoralists in this region.
Look, I'd like to see a cohesiveness. I'd like to see the collaboration of pastoral companies, farming companies, corporations, state governments, marketing Australia overseas as one. You know, the small mentality, ultra competitiveness between companies and businesses or states on states when you're overseas just looks puerile. We need, as a country and as an agriculture industry, to market ourselves collectively and together as Australia's food industry, agriculture industry, we can be truly proud of overseas. And why not? You've got fantastic quarantine standards. You've got a brilliant paddock-to-plate product. You've got animal welfare, which is leading the world. And people should feel great about eating Australian food.
That's Andrew Forrest speaking at Mindaroo Station in WA's Pilbara, speaking with our reporter Lucy Bell. We also heard from Nicola Forrest and the station manager Ben Ratton. We're going to stay in the Pilbara this morning because at the moment the WA Outback is having one of its best seasons for wildflowers. And those splashes of colour across the landscape are being captured on canvas by local Indigenous artists. They're busy preparing for annual exhibitions right around the state. Lucy Bell took a tour of the Yinja Barney Art Group in the Pilbara town of Roebourne.
I'm just blending in the colours and I'm looking at the wildflowers of the Pilbara area at the moment. Whenever I look at flowers, it sort of fascinates me. The blue represents the bluebells and yellows are the wattles. Yeah, I look at the country and the time and the season of the flowers, just pink and white mullamullas. Hi, my name is Ellery Sandy. I'm a chair for the Yinja Barney Art, which is the old Delgatty House. Most of us do art here. As you can see, Celia's work is about circles and you're just using the three basic colours, the white, grey and the black. Justina, she works quietly. She does those little strokes which really only her eyes can see, the dots and the little ticks that she does in her work. It's a joy to be working, and we find so much peace doing art. That's all it matters, just making someone else happy that they are hanging up in their wall or in the office.
People who might not be that familiar with the art that comes out of this group, what's distinct about Pilbara art from
I
this
think
group?
It's a style and that is their own story, how they capture that story of their country or where they came from. That comes from here, from the heart, and they tell their story. You know, everyone experiences it, and oh, that reminds me of certain things or a certain place, and it's supporting and encouraging each other, and that's all that matters in the art group, you know, just pressing on and doing the best we can for our ability. Like Uncle Clifton, you know, he's an inspiration for us. We have an elder, and we have a couple of young girls that my niece, my Melissa and my Justina, you know, they're encouragement for me.
Melissa, can you tell me a little bit about what you're working on at the moment?
Just a painting I started the other day. It'll represent the wildflowers. When I paint about the country. I have my moods. So if I'm thinking about someone who I've lost, I tend to paint something that reminds me of them and just brings me back. Kind of makes me happy all over again. Painting was just a hobby. I guess you can still call it a hobby, but it's something that I love doing. I couldn't imagine not doing it. It helps me express feelings, express a lot of things. It's made my family proud. When I do a painting, I put a lot into it, so when it's done, I actually feel proud about doing it.
When I look at this one, I think about the iron ore that's been dug up. When the iron ore is finished, the new growth comes, you know, wildflower.
What are some of the big goals for the group and for you yourself, Ellery?
Well, first one, I would like to see the continuing of the role and how we've worked and to be together as always. And if there's always a new member that we could welcome in, especially when the kids come in, you know, they see what nanas and mums are doing and, you know, maybe further down the track when they finish school, or hopefully they'll pick up where we started off, you know. We'll tell our kids, this is how we tell our stories, you know. And everyone tells their story in a different way. And the time will come when we'll take our kids back to the country to actually tell them the story, what we're painting in our canvas. And, yeah, we'll just keep painting the way we are and being strong for each other and encouraging one another. We'll continue to press on, produce work wherever it's needed. Every year we look forward to all the exhibitions that are happening. Wherever our art is needed, you know, we're privileged and honoured to display our work. We could be really proud of where we are today.
That's Ellery Sandy, the chair of the Yinja Barney Art Group in WA's Pilbara region. And that's a Country Breakfast for this week. Thanks to Tim Simons for our technical production. Don't forget you can subscribe to our podcast so you can tune in anytime you like. Just head to abc.net.au/rural. I'm Edwina Farley. Stay with us here on RN.